All right, I'd like to thank the speakers for inviting me here, and the staff has been wonderful with organizing things, so really enjoyed my time here. Okay, so today, yeah, I'm going to talk about some limiting distribution results for one-dimensional random walks in random environments. So start out by just reviewing the model. This may have been talked about some on Monday when I wasn't here, but for just one-dimensional random walk in random environment, it's given in the following way. So an environment is just a collection of numbers omega sub x, all between 0 and 1. And we're going to pick it randomly, and for this talk, we'll assume that the sequence omega sub x is just IID. So we have an IID random environment, and it's an environment for a walk in the sense that we're going to run a random walk on it, and the probability when you're at site x of going to the right will be omega sub x, and otherwise you'll step to the left. Okay? So given an environment, you can run a random walk on it, and the distribution of the random walk for the fixed environment omega is denoted P sub omega, and that's called the quenched law of the random walk. And then we can average the quenched law over all environments, and we get what's called the averaged or annealed law of the random walk. Okay? And one thing I just want to emphasize, again, this is rather basic, but these quenched probabilities are probabilities that depend on the environment. Okay, so any quenched probability is not just a number between 0 and 1. It's a random variable, okay, because it's a function of the environment, which itself is random. Okay, and that's going to be very important later on. Okay, so just a quick review of what are sort of the very first basic results in one-dimensional random walks in random environments. So this was done by, this is a seminal paper in 1975 by Fred Solomon, and he handled recurrence and transience and law of large numbers. So if you want to know when is the walk recurrent or transient, the answer is sort of not what the naive guess would be, which would be the sort of the average probability of stepping to the right is bigger than half. The correct answer is, you form this statistic rho, which is the probability to go left divided by the probability to go right, and then you take the log of that and then take the expected value, and that tells you about recurrence or transient. So in particular, if the expected value of log of rho is negative, then you're transient to the right. Okay? On a more fine level, after you know recurrence and transience, then you want to know maybe about law of large numbers. So assume that you're transient to the right. You want to know how fast do you go to the right. And the answer is you have a limiting velocity where the formula is given in terms of this function of the expected value of rho if the expected value of rho is less than 1 and 0 otherwise. So the interesting part about this law of large numbers, well, a couple of interesting parts, first of all, that you can compute it explicitly, but secondly, more interesting is the second part, that you can be transient but with zero speed. Okay? Okay, then more along the lines of what I want to talk about after we know about recurrence and transience and the law of large numbers would be a limiting distribution result. So this was done soon after Solomon's paper. Kesten, Kozloff, and Spitzer proved the following limiting distributions result. So once you're given a distribution on environment, and we're going to assume that the expected value of log of rho is negative, so we know we're transient to the right, then you want to solve this equation. You want to solve the expected value of rho to the kappa equals 1. Maybe I'll write that down here because kappa is going to be important. Okay? And it's the solution to the expected value of rho to the kappa equals 1. Okay? So once you know what that number kappa is, then it tells you what the limiting distributions are for the random walk, or what the limiting distribution is. Okay? So the simplest case is when kappa is bigger than 2. So if kappa is bigger than 2, then the limiting distribution that you get is the normal central limit theorem type result, right? You center by the speed, and you scale by some constant times the square root of n, and what you get on the right-hand side is the distribution function for a standard normal random variable. Okay, so that's completely sort of what you would expect. The more interesting thing are the other cases. Okay, so if kappa is between 1 and 2, this is still in the case where you have a positive speed. So we center by the speed, but now we scale by n to the 1 over kappa, so something larger than square root of n. And the distribution that we have over here is a kappa stable random variable. Okay? So L sub kappa b is some completely asymmetric kappa stable distribution. Okay, I'll maybe talk a little bit more about specifically what that distribution is in a little bit. Okay, and why it comes up. And then if kappa is between 0 and 1, this is now the zero speed case where you're transient with zero speed. Well, you have to have sort of some sort of speed to infinity, but it's actually sublinear, right? You don't center by anything, you just scale by n to the kappa. Okay? So essentially the rate at which you're going to infinity is n to the kappa, where kappa is less than 1. So when you scale that way, the limiting distribution that you get is some funny transformation of a stable random variable. Okay? So I've heard other people call this a Mittag-Leffler distribution. Okay? So I'd like to explain a little bit the proof of this. It goes, actually, Kestin, Kozloff, and Switch's proof went indirectly for the distribution for the walk. They actually first prove a limiting distribution for the hitting time. So T sub n is going to be the hitting time of location n. Okay? And you have this sort of rough equality here, right? So the first probability here says, well, this is the probability that the amount of time it takes me to reach site n is larger than time t, which is essentially the same thing as saying at time t I'm to the left of site n. Okay, not exactly, but morally they're close. And you can use that sort of rough equality, you can make it precise, and transfer limiting distributions from hitting times to the actual location of the walk. So here's the statement that they proved for the limiting distributions of the hitting times. So we get sort of a standard central limit theorem when kappa is bigger than 2. When kappa is between 1 and 2, we center and we scale by n to the 1 over kappa, and we get a kappa stable random variable. And when kappa is between 0 and 1, we just scale by n to the 1 over kappa and get a kappa stable random variable. Okay, so a couple remarks. Why did I show you both? Well, I guess it's sort of most natural to talk about the limiting distribution of the position of the random walk, right? But the statement is a lot cleaner for the limiting distribution of the hitting times, okay? And that's also the way that the proof goes. So also, once you, the main sort of thing is that if you know the limiting distributions for the hitting times, you can infer something about the random walk, okay? And so for the rest of the talk, I'm actually just going to be focusing on the limiting distributions for the hitting times, and then, you know, you can do some work to get things for the walk itself. Okay, and then actually from this setup, it's actually a little bit easier to see why you might, after the fact of seeing it, why you might actually expect these kappa stable distributions coming up. Okay, so the reason is, well, we can write the hitting times nicely as a telescoping sum. Right, the time that it takes to get to site n is the time that it takes to go from site I minus 1 to site I, and you add all those up. Okay? So if you have n random variables, and suppose that they're IID and heavy-tailed, right? So, for instance, if you had a bunch of random variables that were non-negative and heavy-tailed in the sense that the probability that the random variable is bigger than x decays like some constant times x to the minus kappa. Okay? So then these limiting distributions are exactly what you would get once you, if you're looking for, I guess, limiting distributions of the sum of the yi. Okay? So it's a completely asymmetric kappa stable random variables because the random variables that you were summing up were non-negative to begin with. Okay? So if these random variables were IID and heavy-tailed, then this is what we would expect. Okay? It turns out these random variables are heavy-tailed, but they're not independent. Okay? So maybe one way you can see this, and it's crucial also that they're not independent under the averaged measure. Right? So suppose I tell you that the time that it takes to get from 0 to 1 is very, very large. Okay? That tells you something about the environment near the origin, or actually just to the left of the origin, right? If the amount of time it takes to go one step to the right is very large, then there's probably a local drift or strong local drift to the left near the origin, okay? That tells you then that there's a decent chance of the amount of time that it takes to go from 1 to 2 also being large, because you know something about the environment near the origin, okay? So these random variables are not independent, but the independence is actually pretty weak, okay? Because if I know what the amount of time it took to go from 0 to 1, it doesn't tell me much about the amount of time it's going to take to go from 100 to 101, okay? Because any information that I got from the amount of time it takes to go from 0 to 1 only tells me about the environment to the left of 0, and once I reach site 100, I'd have to go all the way back to site 0 to sort of make this independence fall apart, and that's pretty unlikely. Okay? So at least morally, this maybe tells you a little bit where these limiting distributions, where these average limiting distributions are coming from. Okay? So that's just a very brief review of the state-of-the-art random walks, random environments 35 years ago. So when I was working on my thesis at Minnesota, problem Ofer gave me to work on was, well, let's start looking at the same sort of question. Let's look at the limiting distribution of the random walk, or I guess we'll be working with hitting times, but under the quenched distribution. Okay, so fix an environment and then ask the question, what's the distribution of the random walk in that environment after a long time? Okay, so the first case that we handled was the case kappa bigger than 2. This is where you get the central limit theorem and things are easier. Okay, so this was actually at the same time as I did this. Ilya Goldschied did essentially the same thing independently. And we got the following result. So here it's stated for the hitting times, and here it's stated for the random walk. So first of all, just looking at the hitting times, what it says is you center and you scale by the square root of n, and you get a Gaussian distribution. Okay, and there's a corresponding result for the walk. So there's a couple remarks that are important. First of all, both of these statements require a random centering. Okay, random in the sense that it depends on the environment. Okay, you would maybe want to replace the centering by n divided by v, where v is the limiting velocity, right? You'd like to replace it by a deterministic thing. You actually can't. If you try to do that, you get the wrong. You do not get a limiting distribution. Okay, so you have to. Once you're given the environment, that tells you how you are supposed to center. But then you can scale deterministically and get a limiting distribution. And secondly, I guess minor point, the thing you scale by some constant times the square root of n, it's actually a different constant than you would scale by in the averaged limiting distribution. Okay, so this next slide will explain, I guess, the proof of this quenched central limit theorem and some of those remarks a little bit more. So how do you prove the quenched central limit theorem? Well, first of all, you write the hitting time is this telescoping sum. And now, since we're working quenched, we have a Markov chain. Okay, so now these random variables are independent. Okay? But they're not identically distributed. Okay, because we're in an inhomogeneous environment. Well, how do you prove a central limit theorem for sums of independent but not identically distributed random variables? You just use Lindbergh-Feller. Okay? So it's not very high powered, and it's actually not that hard to prove the quenched central limit theorem for the hitting times. In fact, it was done about around 2001 by Alili. But he wasn't. He actually got stuck then trying to. If I go back to this, so Alili proved the quenched central limit theorem for the hitting times, And then he wanted to prove the quintessential limit theorem for the random walk itself. But the fact that you have this random centering, you have an environment-dependent centering, actually makes it kind of difficult. Okay, so it took a little bit of work then to invert from time to space. Another remark is that once you have the quenched central limit theorem, you actually can recover the average central limit theorem in the following way. Okay, so this is the thing that you're proving a limiting distribution for under the averaged measure. Okay, we center deterministically. If we add and subtract the quenched centering, we can just write it as this sum. Okay, now the quenched central limit theorem, what it says is that it was actually, if I go back, I guess I should have mentioned this. This convergence here, again, these are random probabilities. So these are random variables on the left that are converging to a deterministic number on the right. So the convergence is almost sure convergence. So what it says is, you give me any environment, and with probability one, that environment satisfies this limit. Okay? So what that tells us here is that this random variable here, no matter what environment you give me, this random variable is Gaussian, or close to Gaussian, right? So it's essentially a Gaussian random variable that's independent of the environment. This thing over here is just a function of the environment. So we are able to write this thing that we're looking at in two parts, one that depends on the environment and one which is independent of the environment. Moreover, this second part that only depends on the environment, you can actually show that it also is asymptotically Gaussian. Okay? So essentially what you have is you have the sum of two independent Gaussian random variables, so then you get another Gaussian. And that also explains why the scaling is different for the averaged central limit theorem. Okay? So that was the easy case. The question that we were actually really interested in was the more fun stuff when you've got these kappa stable random variables showing up. Okay? So we asked what are the limiting distributions when kappa is less than 2? Okay? And you can actually do the same sort of decomposition when the case when kappa is less than 2. And we're wondering, okay, maybe we get a quenched stable distribution plus some independent stable random variable, and you add two stables together and get a stable. Okay? So that's what we were shooting for. It turns out that's actually wrong. Okay? Something much more interesting is going on. So here's actually what I was able to prove in my thesis about 3 years ago. We showed, in fact, that when kappa is less than 2, there are no quenched limiting distributions. Okay? What that means is you give me an environment, and with probability 1, the random walk or the hitting times do not have a limiting distribution. So how do you show that something doesn't have a limiting distribution? You have to show, you know, two different subsequences that converge to different things. Okay, so here's what we do. You give me an environment with probability 1, I can get two subsequences. I'll call them n sub k and m sub k. I can look at the environment. I can pick out these subsequences of locations such that the hitting time properly centered in scale will center, you know, sort of in the nicest possible way, so it has mean 0 and variance 1. Along one set of those subsequences, you get a Gaussian distribution. And along another subsequence, you get this centered exponential random variable. Okay? Now, there's no way to take, and it's not that I didn't center or scale intelligently enough, because there's no way to transform an exponential random variable into a Gaussian. Okay? So that tells you that no matter what centering and scaling you pick, you cannot get a limiting distribution. Okay? So this was essentially the main part of my thesis, and I would go around and give this talk, and sort of many of you probably have seen this, and I was very happy with this because it got me my PhD. But then people in the audience were sometimes less than happy because it's kind of a negative result. Okay, and we want to understand, well, what's really going on. So I would get all these questions. Well, which of those limits is more likely, right? Maybe usually it's really looking like a Gaussian distribution, but there's this sort of occasional exponential thing popping up. What other subsequential limits are possible? You showed that there were two. Are there other ones? Okay, I think I knew which ones were, but I hadn't proved it yet, I wasn't motivated to show more limits at that point. And then the third question is, okay, you showed me this decomposition before, that we were thinking maybe the Kappa stable distributions on the average case could be explained as the sum of something that depends on the environment and something that doesn't. So this shows that intuition is wrong. Can we sort of give another intuition as to where the Kappa stable random variables come from? Okay, so the rest of the talk I'd like to explain sort of answering these frequently asked questions by showing really what is really going on. Okay? Why is there no quenched limiting distribution and what is going on in the long term? Okay? So here's sort of the question we should have asked. Okay? So what I showed in my thesis is if Kappa is less than 2, I know that there's no limiting distribution. So no matter what centering and scaling I pick, a probability like this is not going to converge. So here I pick the quench centering and a deterministic scaling. Okay? So these are random variables. You fix an X and these are random variables. And I know that they're not going to converge to a deterministic constant. So once I tell you that, I have a bunch of random variables that don't converge to a deterministic constant. Then the next question should have been, well, do they converge in some weaker sense, right? I have a bunch of random variables. Maybe they can converge in distribution, okay? And that's, in fact, what actually happens, okay? So if you take the random variables and you center them by the quench centering and you scale deterministically, you can show that these random variables actually converge in distribution, okay? When we did the proof, we actually figured out that what we were really proving is something stronger, okay? But we need to be a little bit more abstract. So let script M sub 1 be the space of probability distributions on the real line, okay? So then you give me an environment and you fix a large number N, and I can form these probability distributions. Okay, so these are the distributions of the hitting time properly centered and scaled. So when Kappa is bigger than 2, we'll scale by square root of n, and when Kappa is less than 2, we'll scale by n to the 1 over Kappa. Okay, and what's important to note is that these are probability distributions, but they're random, right? They're because they depend on the environment. So these are M1 valued random variables. Okay, and in fact, what we're able to show is that these random variables on the space M1, they're the distribution of mu sub n omega converges to the a distribution on the space M1. So these random variables converge to a random probability distribution. Okay? So just saying this a little bit more concretely, or I guess again, In the case Kappa bigger than 2, when we have a quenched central limit theorem. So this is a quenched limiting distribution. It tells us, in fact, that these random probability distributions converge to a deterministic probability distribution, which is the standard Gaussian. Okay, and so this is almost sure convergence in the space M1. What we're going to show is what I call a weak quenched limiting distribution. So this would be a strong quenched limiting distribution. This is a weak quenched limiting distribution in the sense that mu sub n omega converges in distribution on the space M1. Okay? So, no. Kappa is less than 2. It's going to converge in distribution to a random probability measure, which I'll describe in a little bit. Okay? So, actually, on this slide. So, here's the statement of the theorem. And, oh, I forgot to say this at the beginning. This is work with Gennady Semrednitsky at Cornell. And actually, when there was about a week and a half period in December when Gennady and I posted this paper on the archive, and Dmitry Dolgopat and Ilya Goldschied posted a paper with the same result, and also Christophe Sabot and some co-authors in France posted a paper on the archive with the same result, all within like a week and a half. So I want to give them credit, especially since both members of both of the other groups are here. Okay, so what's the limit? So if kappa is less than 2, these random probability distributions converge in distribution on the space M1 to a random probability distribution, which I'll denote mu sub lambda kappa. It has two parameters. One is kappa, which we already know, and the other one is going to be lambda, which is like this scaling factor. Okay? And what is the distribution mu sub lambda? Okay? Well, I guess I forgot to write something down here. We want to know what the probability of the interval A is. Okay? And it's the probability that this random sum is in A, where these tau sub i's, I forgot to mention on the slide, tau sub i's are, wherever you see them the rest of the talk, they're IID exponential with parameter 1. Okay? So we've got a bunch of exponential random variables, and we center them by the mean. And then we multiply by these coefficients A sub i. Okay? And this probability is actually conditioned on what these events A sub i are. So this probability is the probability that some mixture of exponential random variables is in A. Okay? So the distribution mu sub lambda kappa is the distribution of some mixture of exponential random variables. But it's random because the mixing coefficients, these A sub i's, are themselves going to be drawn randomly. Okay? And how do we get them? Well, the A sub i's are the atoms of a non-homogeneous Poisson point process with this intensity. Okay? So I'll show a little picture of what this looks like in a little bit, but think of this, again, think of it in terms of an environment, a random walk in a random environment. So in some sense, these atoms of the non-homogeneous Poisson point process serve as your environment. Okay? And the exponential random variables serve as what's happening for the random walk. Okay? And so I want to know what the quench distribution is. Okay? So I have this sum, and if I'm looking at quench distributions, that means I fix the atoms of this Poisson point process, and then I just look at what's the distribution of this sum conditioned on knowing what the values of A sub i are. Okay? Again, it's just a scaling coefficient. It's because, if I go back, I just scaled by n to the 1 over kappa. I didn't, you know, if I put some constant under there. Okay? Uh-huh. No. No, I'm centering by the quenched mean. So the quenched mean is finite. But the expected value of the quenched mean is infinite. Yep. I'll show something else in a little bit. But okay, so up until a few months ago, I knew a lot less about non-homogeneous Poisson point processes, so I'll be kind to those of you who knew as little as I did a few months ago. Okay, everyone knows, hopefully, what a sort of homogeneous Poisson point process is, right? We sums of exponential random variables. If you take a homogeneous Poisson point process, so gamma I are those points, and you form the other point process, so you take gamma I to the minus 1 over kappa, and then you scale it in some way, okay? Then you actually get, what you get is this non-homogeneous Poisson point process with that intensity. So that's one way of getting it. And you can see what it looks like. In fact, there's a largest point, and then a second largest, and then there's all this accumulation of points near zero. Okay? So that mixture of exponentials, it's sort of mostly determined by the few largest points in this process. Okay, so that's what this non-homogeneous Poisson point process is. I also, with Gennady, another statement of our results is the following. We were actually able to do things with the average centering instead of the quench centering. So in the previous one, I looked at the distribution when you centered by the quench mean and scale deterministically. What if we center and scale the exact same way as Keston, Kozloff, and Spitzer did? Okay? So here's just the simplest case to describe. It gets harder when kappa is between 1 and 2. But say kappa is between 0 and 1. Then Keston, Kozloff, and Spitzer tell us that we shouldn't center by anything and we should just scale by n to the 1 over kappa. Okay? And then you get this convergence and distribution, and you get the exact same thing except without centering the exponential random variables. Okay? So it's, you know, essentially not anything drastically new. The reason I wanted to say this is that from this, you can recover a proof of Keston, Kozloff, and Spitzer's limiting distributions, right? Because here's the proof. We want to know that this converges in distribution to something, okay? This is an average probability. So average probability is the expected value of quenched probabilities, okay? So it's the expected value of this quenched distribution of the interval minus infinity to x, okay? Well, I know this converges in distribution to some other random probability distribution. So you can, in fact, show, the theorem on the previous page shows, in fact, this convergence, okay? So now what is that? Well, we're taking the expected value of this random probability here. So I just rewrote what that random probability is. It's the sum of these AIs times exponential random variables, okay? But if we're taking the expected value of a conditional probability, we can just forget about the conditioning, right? So now this is just the probability that this random sum is less than or equal to x, where both the AIs and the tau I's are random, okay? So you take AIs that are random from some non-homogeneous Poisson point process, and tau I's are independent exponential random variables, and then you can show that AI times tau I are actually atoms of a non-homogeneous Poisson point process with this intensity. So basically just some other constant times x to the minus kappa minus 1. Okay, and if you have one way of proving stable limit laws is if you have atoms, if you have a Poisson point process with this intensity and you add up all the atoms, the thing that you get is a kappa stable random variable. Okay, so this gives another proof of Keston, Kozloff, and Spitzer's results. Okay. Okay, so I'd like to spend, I guess, got 5 or 10 minutes left, and I'd like to spend a little bit, yeah. I forgot to mention those. Okay, what are the assumptions? The assumptions are the expected value of rho to the kappa is 1. You also need the expected value of rho to the kappa times the log of rho being finite, and you need the distribution of log of rho to be non-lattice. You need both. You need it to get both. Because this... right, because this result allows you to get some really fine asymptotic tail results that you need. And you really need those. Okay. Okay, so I'd like to say a little bit about the proof. So the proof goes through, or at least our proof, goes through analyzing the random walk in the random environment, basically through the potential, or what's called the potential of the environment. Okay, so if you give me an environment, I can form this function, V, which is called the potential, And it's, you know, V of I is the sum of these log of rows from 0 to I minus 1. Okay, so it's just, it looks like this, and it's actually, since the rows of k's are IID, this is actually, you know, a random walk. So it, the potential is pretty well understood, and it has drift negative because we assume the expected value of log of rho is negative. Okay? And it's sort of visually nice because everywhere that the slope is downward, at that point in the environment, you are biased to the right. Everywhere the slope is up, you're biased to the left. So you can think about sort of doing a random walk where you're always sort of drawn downhill. You're more likely to step downhill. Okay? But it's also, it's not just sort of visually nice to see what's going on. It's actually, there's some actual real mathematical content to it. Here you can see actually, there's a simulation here of what the potential shows of what's going on. So random walks in random environments, the crucial thing that happens is even though it's transient to the right, you get these local sections where the drift is to the left. And those trap or they slow down the random walk for a long time. So here you can see the random walk. It gets stuck in some spot for a long time, right? And this spot is spatially between about 80 and 90. Okay, and if we look down spatially in the potential between 80 and 90, we see that there's this spot of the potential where there's this uphill in the potential. Okay, and that's what's causing this sort of strange behavior. Okay, so it turns out that to understand the hitting times or to understand the walk, you really need to understand, what's crucial to understand is how long it takes to get past these traps or these uphill sections. Okay, so the way that that we figured out to deal with this is what we call the ladder locations of the environment. Okay, so here's the potential, and the ladder locations are, starting from 0, nu sub 1 is the first time that the potential drops below 0. And then nu sub 2 is the first next time the potential drops below that. Okay? So we define the ladder locations of the potential. And the nice thing about that is that if there's ever going to be a large uphill that's going to serve as sort of a trap, it has to be contained between two ladder locations. Okay? So these ladder locations sort of partition the environment nicely into the relevant things, okay? They pick out the relevant things that we're going to really care about are how long it takes to cross these hills, okay? So what we really wanted to know was, we wanted to know, study the distribution of t sub n, the amount of time it took to go n steps to the right. Instead, we're actually going to study something different. We're going to study the amount of time it takes to reach the nth ladder location, okay? So the law of large numbers tells me that the nth ladder location is asymptotically some constant times n, okay? So it turns out that studying the time to cross n ladder locations is essentially the same as studying the amount of time it takes to reach some distance c times n, okay? So instead of studying mu sub n omega, instead of proving some weak quench limit for that, we can prove a weak quench limit for the distribution of the hitting time of the nth ladder location. Okay, so that's the first step of the proof. The second step is then, okay, if we need to know how long it takes to cross n of these ladder locations, we need to understand sort of better how long it takes to just cross one of them. Okay, so here's sort of a simple heuristic, at least. So here's this big hill, and we want to know how long is it going to take to get over the hill. Okay, so we can write, well, first of all, maybe we'll just ask the question, starting at the bottom of the hill, what's the probability I get up to the top of the hill before I, say, go one step to the left? And you can write down, there's actually an explicit formula in terms of the potential. And you notice here in the bottom we've got sums of exponentials, but the potential is increasing here. Okay, so that's really just dominated by the last term, the largest term. And so this probability, the probability of crossing some hill, is essentially e to the minus h, where h is the height of this hill in the potential. Okay? And so what you can get is that the time to escape a trap of some depth, or the time to cross a hill of some height, is essentially exponential in that height. And it's not just exponential in size, it's actually exponential in distribution. Okay? Because you can think about this in terms of how long does it take to get across here? Well, I'll just break the amount of time it takes to get across into a bunch of excursions from the bottom. Okay? So the number of excursions that it takes is geometric, and the amount of time that all the failure excursions took was very small. Okay? So you scale a geometric and you get an exponential. So we're actually able to show, here's what we want to do, we want to show that the time to cross, say, to the first lateral location is essentially an exponential random variable with whatever the mean has to be to make the means equal. Okay? And so we do this in the following way. So we can decompose the amount of time it takes to cross to the first lateral location into these, here's a S stands for success, and FI stands for failure. So a successful excursion or a failure excursion. Okay? And the number of failure excursions is some geometric random variable with success probability, just the probability that you cross before returning to the origin. Okay? So in order to compare this random variable to an exponential, we actually couple in the following way. We let our geometric random variable be just some constant times a exponential random variable. Okay, so you can, that's sort of the natural way to couple something exponential with something geometric. And this coupling, in fact, turns out to be good enough to show that this approximation is good. Okay? Okay, so now I'm going to let beta I be the, doesn't seem to be working very well. Okay. Beta I is the quenched expectation of the amount of time it takes to cross from the I minus first to the I ladder location. Okay. And so the coupling that I gave on the last page says that the amount of time, the amount of time to reach the nth ladder location, properly centered and scaled, looks a lot like this. Okay, this, what we have is, now we have a mixture of exponentials. Okay, so now this looks a lot like what the random distribution that I had in the statement of the limit was, right? The only difference is, instead of the beta I divided by n to the 1 over kappa, we had the atoms of a non-homogeneous Poisson point process. Okay, so it turns out, in order to prove the theorem, essentially what you need to show is that the points beta I divided by n to the 1 over kappa converge to the atoms of a non-homogeneous Poisson point process. So here, let me skip some slides because I'm running out of time. But here's what we take. We take this Poisson point process with those as the atoms, beta I divided by n to the 1 over kappa, and we show that, indeed, they do converge to a non-homogeneous Poisson point process with that intensity. Now, I guess it's not so hard to see why this would pop up. So if these beta I, suppose they were independent, identically distributed, and they had heavy tails like this.
Again, what's the beta I?
The beta I's are the, I'll just write it down here. Beta I is the time, the expected amount of time that it takes to cross the, from the I minus first ladder location to the ith ladder location. So we've got this hill, and the expected amount of time it takes to cross the ith hill. Okay? So if the beta I's were heavy-tailed and independent and identically distributed, this is a standard result. Okay? So it turns out that they're almost, okay? They're not independent and identically distributed. They're almost stationary. So we'll assume that they're stationary. They're not independent, but for the same reason that I said before, how the crossing times under the average measure are not independent, but they're sort of independent enough. The mixing properties are pretty good. Okay? And they have heavy tails. So the beta 1 is in some sense comparable to e to the h, where h is the height of the hill, and it's a standard result in renewal theory that the height of the hill, the exponential of the height of the hill, has these nice tails like that. Okay, so using those sorts of results, you can at least see morally why this result should be true. Okay, so I think essentially once you have a good understanding of these coefficients beta sub I, and you reduce the problem to this mixture of exponentials by the coefficients beta sub I, then you sort of immediately get what the random limiting or random probability distribution should be in the limit. So that's where I'll end. Okay.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know that stuff. So. Okay. I'd be interested in hearing more about that. Yes. Okay. So I knew that I had this. I knew that I could reduce it to the sums of exponential random variables. Okay. So. Here's the thing that you get in the limit: the sum of the exponential random variables, and I centered them. Okay, so if you have a sum of exponential random variables, the first thing we thought about was, well, you sum up, you know, random variables with nice tails, then you're going to get a Gaussian random variable. Okay, but it turns out that these coefficients can be nasty. So if these coefficients in the limiting result, right? These a sub i's are coming from a non-homogeneous plus one-point process, okay? But let's look at sort of the support of this, of what this can be, right? If you let a sub 1 be 1 and all the other a sub i's be 0, then what you have here is an exponential random variable, okay? On the other hand, let's take the other extreme, or another extreme. Let the first 1,000 a sub i's be 1 and everything after that be 0. Then you're summing up a bunch of identically distributed exponential random variables. So the thing you get should be approximately Gaussian. Okay? So it's in that sense that I thought of exponential and Gaussian. Okay? So one extreme is you've got one huge coefficient and everything else small. Another extreme is you've got a huge number of coefficients that are the same and everything else small.